Session number 11938, Reel 24.
Mr. G. Iston, Reel 24. You got to Habanea. What happened next, Mr. Iston?
Well, I think we had another day's rest here. And I should have mentioned that the carriers were left in Kirkuk to the base ordnance workshops in just outside of Kirkuk. Kirkuk. again, with the Indian depot at just outside of Kirkuk. This depot, I didn't mention it before, it was really a marvellous place. It was in a wadi, which was very bad to see, and unless you knew the way into it, you would go straight past it. And I suppose the same thing happened from the air. It was so narrow that it would be bad to see. And, of course, being in the wadi, if you had people on the tops of the hills, it was fairly easy to defend. Was really in a marvellous place, and I think it was really the base of the 10th Indian Division, or maybe some corps, the corps the 10th Indian Division was in. so the carriers were left there, and of course they were travelling on transport just like anybody else. Kirkuk, we got back up to the desert again, and we were travelling in Arrowhead formation, desert formation. Travelling alongside the pipeline again, back to Rutba Wells and Mafraq. Again, open country, nothing really much to excite anybody apart from the dust and finding a pumping station that had some water, an oil pumping station that had some water to quench the thirst, which is really beyond a joke now. When we got to Mafraq, we were told, much as we'd expected in fact, that we were not going to Syria anymore, but we had to make all speed and get up the desert as fast as we could, because after one of the pushes we were being driven back again by Rommel, and a stand was being made at Ghazala, and we had to get up the desert as fast as possible. So we travelled down the Jordan Valley, which is now really amazing after the desert, to get in among, I suppose really there's only about 5 miles of it either side of the Jordan, but it's green, it's cultivated, there are trees, there are plants, there's colour, there's oranges, there's lemons, there's apples, there's, it's unbelievable, and it does sort of give you the feeling of the Garden of Eden. It seems as though it has got everything. It's reasonably cool. We've been in the valley, and it is really, really good. But that wasn't the situation for us, because we now were as fast as we could to get up the desert. And in fact, we spent a night at Fufula, which is quite close to Nazareth. And I did get the opportunity of visiting Nazareth, but not to inspect anything, really. Being a little bit freelance, I was sent off to do a job, and it just a little diversion. I was in Nazareth. And I also had to go to Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv was remarkable. In those days, it was skyscrapers, white concrete, wide streets, tarmac streets. Complete contrast to what we had seen in Baghdad and all the way up the desert. It was just a complete contrast. And a complete contrast to Haifa, in fact, which was the seaport, the main seaport. But Tel Aviv was modern. And Jewish, I suppose. There was a lot of Jewish money into it. It was really modern. And this was shaking in a sense, that to see this modern place. But the change of scenery from the desert to the Jordan Valley, it's, I can't describe it. It's, it was just tremendous. And we travelled down the desert to the railhead at Tulkarm. And the troops, they had a tea and a wash. And they boarded the train at Tulkarm, which took them through Palestine and through the Sinai to Alcantara. Alcantara is Alcantara East and Alcantara West. I can't give them the Arabic version of it, but that's what it means. It's Alcantara East and Alcantara West. And they got off the train at Alcantara East and caught the ferry across the canal to Alcantara West, and got on the train and went straight up the desert to the railhead. The MT, we went down through some area and south, and we spent the night, I can't just remember where, but not far from Bethlehem. And Bethlehem again was beautiful. After dropping the troops off at Tulkarm, we seemed to be in a bit back in the desert, a sort of halfy-halfy. Not the bleak desert that we had seen, but hills, but still not a lot of cultivation.
The troops had gone by rail, and does this mean that every truck you had was travelling?
The RASC truck, the transporters, the troop carrying, the RASC troop carriers, they stayed, as far as we were concerned, in Palestine. Where they went from there, I mean, we were finished with them at Tulkarm.
This was just a small MT section.
This was our own, well, it's not small, you know.
How big was it?
I think at this stage, to be extended, we're still about 80 miles. You know, in the extended version, the aircraft version, was still about 80 miles long. So it isn't small, even then. And we went, and we must have spent the night somewhere near Bethlehem, because I also got the opportunity to go into Bethlehem. Again, probably I wasn't intended to be there, and I didn't really have time to look at the things I would like to have seen, but I called. And I had a good look around, in a sense, but it was a beautiful country. The orange groves and the lemons and dates, figs. It was really, and the spring, you see, was just really getting to its best. Like, through Bethlehem, we followed on down the centre of Palestine, and through Beersheba, another great name in the Bible, but again, very disappointing to actually see it. The road is very, very wide. I suppose it's something like 120 feet wide, and houses on either side. Well, that is all. If it hadn't been for the sign of Beersheba, I wouldn't have known we were there. Still, good. It was good to see it, and it was mud houses. Quite interesting, because there's a lot of stories in the Bible about Beersheba. And then down the desert to the border. Now, just before the border, we stopped the night in a British-Palestinian camp. And again, just like the one in Cyprus, it's really marvellous, in the desert, and suddenly turn off the road and hit this camp with the palm trees and the paved roads, barrack buildings. I can't recall it. No, I can't recall it. And I'm a bit disappointed, because my brother-in-law was there, and one I never knew. He died in Palestine. In fact, he was with the Yorkshire Dragoons. And I've tried many times to remember the name of this camp, in case it's the one that concerns him. But I'm afraid the name isn't there. But again, I've got to specify that these camps were something out of the ordinary, coming off the desert and into a... And it must have been planted during the British occupation, because the rest of the place, there is nothing. And you've got to think about, if we did this in a period of 20 years, what can the Jews do on the desert in there while they're there? And I think from the photos I've seen recently, you've got to imagine that this is the sort of thing that can be done with the desert if somebody's got the will and the money to do it. I mean, I talked about Cyprus being an island forest in the early days, and then when we were there, the centre of Cyprus was purely desert, cultivated in places, but the majority of it was desert. And it's heartbreaking to think that possibly even the Sahara and the Western Desert was covered with trees at one time. It had been taken down to make boats and ships, and we finish up with a place like the Sahara. And visiting Lincoln a few years ago, I see the same thing happening in Lincoln, where we've got these wide open places, no hedges, and the wind blowing the soil off the top of the fields. Which now, looking back, it sort of makes you stop and think. Well, the following day, leaving this Palestine camp, we're then out, straight out through the wire, into Egypt and the White Sinai Desert. Now that is painful. It's painful on the eyes because the reflection from the sand, whichever way you're travelling, I mean on the morning with the east, sun in the east, it was still reflecting back at you, and at night when the sun was coming from the west, and in your eyes, more or less, it was still reflecting straight off at you. And apart from that, there was the dust flying all over the place. The Sinai, I'm afraid, well, I was very pleased to get through that. And we crossed the canal. I can't remember the place, but I do remember the little narrow wooden bridge. Well, it was a portable bridge which could be swung round and over the canal or not, I don't know, but I do remember this wooden bridge, and we're only allowed across one at a time. There's no way they'd allow two vehicles onto the bridge at any one time, which lost us quite a lot of time, because it meant that vehicles had to stop. In fact, we were tailed back. I described how we should travel 120 yards apart, but in cases like this where you're only allowed one on a particular piece of road at a time, it means that someone's got to stop, and then you get this flashing back a thing. So we crossed the desert, the canal, somewhere I would think just at the top, at the north end of the great Bitter Lake. And from there, we must have gone south of Cairo, I think. I'm puzzled as to why, as to the route. I can only think that maybe it was to be kept more or less secret, because we travelled in desert more than on the roads. I mean, there's a good road down the coast from Palestine through the Sinai, and we did touch part of it in one place. But this was a good road that we're on, going through the centre of the Sinai, but I think that we're probably being hidden rather than going through Cairo, and we went right around Cairo and hit the desert track from Cairo to El Amira, which is just south of the Salt Lake at Alexandria. There, I should think, for the last 5 hours before we hit El Amira, it takes a bit of sitting, we had the Kamshin, and this was something we'd seen dust. But mainly it had been dust that we had created, or which the people in front of us had created. There was some wind dust, but not on the Sinai. The wind was blowing a bit. But this was nothing. I mean, you couldn't see the top of it. You could see on the Sinai even, you could see the top of the layer of dust. But here you couldn't see the top of it at all. It was just like being a very strong, hard cloud. But the cloud was dust and stinging to the face, or sting to any place where it made contact.
Did you continue to drive through it?
Oh yes, yes. But we closed up. We closed up to about 60. Well, in fact, some places we closed up to about 20 yards.
Who was navigating this long journey back? Was it your MCO?
I think. Well, Lockhart was in charge. Mike Lockhart was the man in charge. I think the QM was with us as well. I think Frank Robson was with us, because a lot of his stuff was with the convoy. And I suppose the QMs, the CQMSs and maybe the RQMS went with the troops on the train, and they would look after anything that was to be done there. Well, I'm nearly certain the QM, Frank Robson, was with us, and the MTO. I was thinking that Captain Joy was there, but I don't know. I think he must have gone with the troops. I can't imagine the medical officer with us, but I still have a feeling he might be. So which one was actually navigating? I think it must have been Mike Lockhart. But it wasn't too difficult to navigate then. It was on roads. We weren't crossing deserts or anything. And even in Iraq, you see, we'd had the pipeline. If we got adrift, we knew the pipeline was right of us, and we headed right until we hit the pipeline, then eastwards, and we had a good idea where we wanted to be. So whether it was the intention that we were hidden or not, but why, if that was the case, why did we go to Alamira against Alexandria? We could have cut the desert to the railhead from Cairo, from south of Cairo. I don't know. Certainly went to Alamira. Amaria. And there was a massive naffy. One of the biggest I've ever seen, I think. And we spent the night there, and we had a drink. It was the first one we really had since leaving Chrisassen. We had a drink in Chrisassen when we first landed. Well, we'd had a few drinks in Cyprus, but apart from that, this was the first real drink we'd had. Which didn't do us any good for the next day, really, because then we were heading straight up the desert, up the desert track, which was just south of the coast road. We've got the Mediterranean, and the coast road runs quite close to it. And then just south of that, there's what they call the desert track, which we were using to get onto the desert itself.
What are the problems of driving on the desert? And particularly, of course, this being your first experience of it. What problems are we coming across?
Well, as been said many times, the desert is just like a woman, as changeable as can be. In fact, it doesn't change every day, it changes every hour. The most of the Western Desert is good, hard sandstone. And it resembles a road which has been built in this country before. It's got the tarmac on the top. When they're building a road, they've got a good scree of hard stuff down and roll it in. And the desert, in most places, is like that. But every now and again, it can look like that, but it is just slightly a different colour, possibly just a shade more green. And that is a salt layer on top of soft sand. There's very little difference between the colour of the sandstone and this layer of salt. The problem being, of course, that once you get through the salt, then you're into soft, what would you describe it, floury sand. And you just sink straight down. If you try to turn the wheel at all, it just goes straight down. It doesn't push along. It just digs. And then, of course, you've got to find some way of jacking it up, and which is a problem in itself, and getting a sand track, which is a length of steel sheet, hard sheet, possibly 3/8 of an inch thick. It's a channel with holes through it, and possibly 2 yards long. And you get this under the wheel, and then that does enable the vehicle to move. But of course, if you get through this sand, you've probably got all 4 wheels down. And then the only real thing is to find, either going in, you probably bring the vehicle backwards, because then you know that if you're trying to pull it out, you're stood on firm ground. But then again, you think you're on firm ground, and once you take the extra weight of the vehicle that you try to pull out, that goes down as well. So it's not as firm as you would expect. In fact, later on when we got towards Benghazi, a little shower of rain, this could be all mud. quite firm. But all he did is a little shower of rain, and it was just mud that skidded, and you couldn't do a thing about it. So, just like a lady, as the gentleman said, it can change every hour. Further on, it might be all boulders, like lava stone, which are very difficult to drive over because they slide, and if a tyre gets onto them, the boulder just shoots, and it's like a bomb landing. You know, it can just shoot anywhere because they're rounded. They're lava stones that have been rounded on, and it's round, and if a tyre gets on the side, it'll shoot anywhere. there's always the wind to contend with. There are no landmarks once you get to the desert, away from the sea. I mean, the sea's there, you know, it's on your right-hand side, and you know that is north. By using your watch, using the hour on the watch, you can tell from the sun the direction. Later, the vehicles were all fitted with sun compasses, but we hadn't got some sun compasses at this stage.
How did they operate?
The sun compass was like a sundial, a stick in the middle of a round table. And on the table, there were various marks, sort of north, east, south and west, as you might say, or divided into quarters. And you had a card with the hours on it. And you moved the car every hour so that the hour in question pointed to the right direction. So that if you started at midday, you would have 12 o'clock pointing directly ahead of you. And as the day moved round, the card went round every hour, so you should still be looking, the needle should still register in the same direction. A bit difficult to explain. But the thing was that you moved the card around every hour, and then that brought the correct angle of travel into place with the line and the shadow cast by the pin in the middle. And they were really, really successful. Unless you got the cam sheen, of course, and then you didn't have any sun, did you? It was just sand, so you had no guide then. You had to rely, again, on the magnetic compass. The magnetic compass, I mean, was always the standby. A lot of people did develop such a sense that at night they could travel by the stars. Again, you've got to add hours here and there to the position of a star, and you can pick the direction that you need from that. I did quite well myself, really. In fact, it's something I regret dropping now because they're interesting things, stars. It is something that I regret dropping now.
You could steer by the stars,
yes, in a general direction. You couldn't pinpoint, but it would give you a general direction. If you knew your stuff well enough and you had a sextant, you could pinpoint. But from the eye, it was a general direction, and basically that was all you wanted.
So you're moving up the desert towards the Ghazala. Were there any signs or indications of what any fighting that had gone on before, in the months before?
Oh, once through the frontier, there was signs all over. Tanks, trucks, ambulances, minefields marked, you know, with wire around them, and the REs talking about defaulters that we were before. For the Royal Engineers, when they had defaulters, they were given the job of cutting flimsy petrol cans into triangles, and they were painted and the skull and crossbones put on them to denote a milestone. It was done as a general fatigue at one stage, but it got so tedious the lads rebelled against it, and I'm afraid it went to the Jankerwallers, as they were known, the defaulters. And that was the RE's type of punishment, was to make these triangles and paint them with a skull and crossbones. So you, all the way you had these barbed wire fences with the skull and crossbones on them, denoting that there was a minefield. And there could be ours or German. The Germans were generally in black for some reason, but ours, I think, nearly always red. with the white skull and crossbones on, but the Germans theirs were black, I think. And of course the name was different. I just forget one. That was just said mines. The Germans said mini florum or something, mind you. I can't remember. I did know. So we proceeded up the desert to the railhead just south of Sidi Barani. This again was shattering because the railway, we'd come alongside the railway then, it was on the right hand side, there was the river, there was the sea, and then the road, and then the railway, and then the desert track was just south of the railway. Oh, and this was a massive expanse of stores and trucks and the railway itself. The station, I think, was a wooden box. That was about all there was in the way of stationary equipment. But the area covered was really terrific. And there is a story that when the troops on the train, de-entrained, there was no run for them in the transit camp. And they had to march another 500 yards to a mile before they could lay themselves down on the desert. But the mass of equipment there, it was, you know, it's hard to believe. And we picked the troops up, and they were there.
So you joined the battalion there?
We joined the battalion, and the TCLs joined us, the troop carrying RSC. They joined up with us again.
About what date would this be?
This was about the 23rd of February. So we'd been travelling 19 days. Which wasn't bad, really, for I think it was about 2,000 miles. And that was 2,000 miles, I think, till we got to Gazala. We got some interesting things now that we passed Sidi Rezeg, Talata, Bertalata, Sidi Abdul Salam, Conference Cairn, and El Adam Airport and Fort Acroma. All places that we'd heard that there'd been fighting. They are all marked, or they were all marked in the desert, as they had a 40-gallon drum painted white as a rule with the name on. Really, that was all there was. The fort had gone. Sidi means, as far as I remember, it means a monument to a cairn to somebody. Probably it takes the name like Sidi Abdul Salam, I suppose. It's the gravestone of Sidi of Abdul Salam. And Sidi Rezeg, probably the gravestone to somebody called Rezeg. We knew these were all battle places, and they were interesting to see. One thing that did shock us was going through past Mirza Matruh Airport, the RAF Mirza Matruh, there the old Gladiators, and that was the only airport Air Force we'd seen at that stage. Obviously, they had some others, but we hadn't seen anyone. There was lots of jokes about our chances with having these gladiators to cover us. So we just carried on, and on the 27th, we arrived in the box at Gazala. And we took over from the 4th Rajputani Rifles. There was a thing about them, that their cap badge was almost the same as ours, black on red. Obviously, with being a rifle troop, they would have a similar type of badge. The box, the Gazala line, there's a place called Ain El Gazala, which is a little place on the coast. And the Gazala line was like a... There was a box right on the coast which contained, I think it was the 1st South African Division. And then there was a brigade of the 2nd South African Division. And they were only a few hundred yards apart. And then further down there was the box of 151 Brigade, the 50th Division, our brigade. And then 69th Brigade, which were almost touching. And then there was a distance of 6 miles before 150 Brigade, which was the other brigade of 50th Division. And then about 13 miles from then, further south again, were the Free French at Burrakim. Now, it wasn't a line. From Ghazala, it swung round left all the way, so each box was behind, slightly behind, the one above it. And it was in a like a semicircle going all the way around to Burrakim.